Whoever did that should be shot. And yet a mid-level painting like this, in poor condition? Even an anonymous work is worth more than a masterpiece, that's the irony of it. Worth more to me, anyway. Landscapes, particularly. Very, very easy to sell. Not too much attention from the authorities. Difficult to recognize from a description. And still worth maybe a couple hundred thousand. Now, the Fabricius. Long, relaxed pause. A different caliber altogether. The most remarkable work that's ever passed through my hands. And I can say that without question. Yes, and that is why we would like so much to get it back, grumbled Boris from the shadows. Completely extraordinary, continued Horst serenely. A still life like this one, he indicated the Kleisch, with a slow wave, yellowed fingernails, scarred Venus network on the back of his hand. Well, so insistently a trompe l'oeil. Great technical skill, but overly refined. Obsessive exactitude. There's a death-like quality. A very good reason they are called nature morte, yes? But the Fabricius. Loose-kneed backstep. I know the theory of the goldfinch. I'm well familiar with it. People call it trompe l'oeil, and indeed it can strike the eye that way from afar. But I don't care what the art historians say. True, there are passages worked like a trompe l'oeil. The wall and the perch. Gleam of light on brass, and then the feathered breast, most creaturely. Fluff and down. Soft. Soft. Kleisch would carry that finish and exactitude down to the death. A painter like Van Hoogstraten would carry it even farther, to the last nail of the coffin. But Fabricius, he's making a pun on the genre, a masterly riposte to the whole idea of trompe l'oeil, because in other passages of the work, the head, the wing, not creaturely or literal in the slightest, he takes the image apart very deliberately to show us how he painted it. Daubs and patches, very shaped and hand-worked, the neckline especially, a solid piece of paint, very abstract, which is what makes him a genius, less of his time than our own. There's a doubleness. You see the mark. You see the paint for the paint, and also the living bird. Yes, well, growled Boris in the dark beyond the spotlight, snapping his cigarette lighter shut. If no paint, would be nothing to see. Precisely. Horst turned, his face cut by shadow. It has a joke at its heart. And that's what all the very greatest masters do. Rembrandt, Velasquez, late Titian. They make jokes. They amuse themselves. They build up the illusion, the trick. But step closer, it falls apart into brush strokes. Abstract, unearthly. A different and much deeper sort of beauty altogether. The thing, and yet not the thing. I should say that one tiny painting puts Fabricius in the rank of the greatest painters who ever lived. And with the goldfinch, he performs his miracle in such a bijou space. Although I admit, I was surprised, turning to look at me, when I held it in my hands the first time, the weight of it. Yes, I couldn't help feeling gratified obscurely that he'd noted this detail, oddly important to me, with its own network of childhood dreams and associations, an emotional cord. The board is thicker than you'd think. There's a heft to it. Heft. Quite. The very word. And the background, much less yellow than when I saw it as a boy. The painting underwent a cleaning. Early 90s, I believe. Post-conservation. There's more light. Hard to say. I've got nothing to compare it to. Well, said Horst. The smoke from Boris's cigarette, threading in from the dark where he sat, gave the floodlit circle where we stood the midnight feel of a cabaret stage. I may be wrong. I was a boy of 12 or so when I saw it for the first time. Yes, I was about that age when I first saw it too.
Well, said Horst,
with resignation, scratching an eyebrow, dime-sized bruises on the backs of his hands. That was the only time my father ever took me with him on a business trip, that time at The Hague. Ice-cold boardrooms, not a leaf stirring. On our afternoon, I wanted to go to Drivlit, the fun park, but he took me to the Moritz House instead. And great museum, many great paintings, but the only painting I remember seeing is your Finch. A painting that appeals to a child, yes? Der Distelfink. That is how I knew it first, by its German name. Ja, 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 said Boris from the darkness in a bored voice. This is like the education channel on the television. Do you deal any modern art at all? I said in the silence that followed. Well, Horst fixed me with his drained, wintry eye. Deal wasn't quite the correct verb. He seemed amused at my choice of words. Sometimes. I had a Kurt Schwitters not long ago. Stanton MacDonald Wright, do you know him? Lovely painter. It depends a lot what comes my way. Quite honestly, do you ever deal in paintings at all? Very seldom. The art dealers get there before I do. That is unfortunate. Portable is what matters in my business. There are a lot of mid-level pieces I could sell on the clean if I had paper that looked good. Spit of garlic, pans clashing in the kitchen, faint Moroccan soup drift of urine and incense. On and on, flatlining, the Sufi drone, wafting and spiraling around us in the dark. Ceaseless chants to the divine. Or this Lépine, quite a good forgery. There's this fellow, Canadian, quite amusing, you'd like him. Does them to order. Pollux, Modiglianis. Happy to introduce you, if you'd like. Not much money in them for me, although there's a fortune to be made if one of them turned up in just the right estate. Then, smoothly in the silence that followed, of older works I see a lot of Italian, but my preferences, they incline to the north, as you can see. Now, this Berkham is a very fine example for what it is, but of course these Italianate landscapes with the broken columns and the simple milkmaids don't so much suit the modern taste, do they? I much prefer the Van Goyen there. Sadly, not for sale. Van Goyen? I would have sworn that was a Corot. From here, yes, you might. He was pleased at the comparison. Very similar painters. Vincent himself remarked it. You know that letter? The Corot of the Dutch? Same tenderness of mist, that openness in fog, do you know what I mean? Where? I'd been about to ask the typical dealer's question, where did you get it, before catching myself. Marvelous painter, very prolific, and this is a particularly beautiful example, he said, with all a collector's pride. Many amusing details up close. Tiny hunter, barking dog. Also, quite typical, signed on the stern of the boat. Quite charming. If you don't mind, indicating with a nod the bodies behind the tapestry. Go over, you won't disturb them. No, but... No, holding up a hand. I understand perfectly. Shall I bring it to you? Yes, I'd love to see it. I must say, I've grown so fond of it, I'll hate to see it go. He dealt paintings himself, Van Goyen. A lot of the Dutch masters did. Jan Steen, Vermeer, Rembrandt. But Jan Van Goyen, he smiled, was like our friend Boris here. A hand in everything. Paintings, real estate, tulip futures. Boris, in the dark, made a disgruntled noise at this, and seemed about to say something when all of a sudden a scrawny, wild-haired boy of maybe 22, with an old-fashioned mercury thermometer sticking out of his mouth, came lurching out of the kitchen and shielding his eyes with his hand against the upheld lamp. He was wearing a weird, womanish, chunky knit cardigan that came almost to his knees like a bathrobe. He looked ill and disoriented. His sleeve was up. He was rubbing the inside of his forearm with two fingers, and then the next thing I knew, his knees went sideways and he'd hit the floor, the thermometer skittering out with a glassy noise on the parquet, unbroken. What? Said Boris, stabbing out his cigarette, standing up, the cat darting from his lap into the shadows. Horst, frowning, set the lamp on the floor, light swinging crazily on walls and ceiling. Ach, he said fretfully, brushing the hair from his eyes, dropping to his knees to look the young man over. Get back, he said in an annoyed voice to the women who had appeared in the door, along with a cold, dark-haired, attentive-looking bruiser and a couple of glassy prep school boys, no more than 16. And then, when they all still stood staring, flicked out a hand.
In the kitchen with you. Ulrika, he said to the blonde. Halt sie zurück.
The tapestry was stirring. Behind it, blanket-wrapped huddles, sleepy voices.
Eh? Was ist los? Ruhe, schlaft weiter,
called the blonde, before turning to Horst and beginning to speak urgently in rapid-fire German. Yawns, groans. Farther back, a bundle sitting up, groggy American wine.
Huh? Klaus? What'd she say? Shut up, baby, and go back zu schlafen.
Boris had picked up his coat and was shouldering it on.
Potter,
he said, and then again when I did not answer, staring horrified at the floor where the boys were breathing in gurgles.
Potter,
catching my arm.
Come on, let's go.
Yes, sorry. We'll have to talk later.
Scheiße,
said Horst regretfully, shaking the boy's limp shoulder with the tone of a parent making a not particularly convincing show of scolding a child.
Dummavisha, Dummkopf.
How much did he take, Niall?
He said to the bruiser who had reappeared in the door, looking on with a critical eye.
Feck if I know, said the Irishman, with an ominous sideways pop of his head. Come on, Potter, said Boris, catching my arm.
Horst had his ear to the boy's chest, and the blonde who had returned had dropped to her knees beside him, checking his airway. As they consulted urgently in German, more noise and movement behind the Amiens which billowed out suddenly. Faded blossoms, a fête champêtre, prodigal nymphs disporting themselves amidst fountain and vine. I was staring at a satyr peeping at them slyly from behind a tree, when, unexpectedly, something against my leg. I started back violently as a hand swiped from underneath and clutched my trouser cuff. From the floor, one of the dirty bundles, swollen red face just visible from under the tapestry, inquired of me in a sleepy, gallant voice.
He's a Margrave, my dear. Did you know that?
I pulled my trouser leg free and stepped back. The boy on the floor was rolling his head a bit and making sounds like he was drowning.
Potter!
Boris had gathered up my coat and was practically stuffing it in my face.
Come on, let's go! Ciao!
He called into the kitchen with a lift of his chin. Pretty dark head appearing in the doorway, a fluttering hand.
Bye, Boris, bye!
As he pushed me ahead of him and ducked behind me out the door.
Ciao, Horst,
he said, making a call me later gesture, hand to ear.
Ciao, Boris. Sorry about this. We'll talk soon.
Up,
said Horst, as the Irishman came up and grabbed the boy's other arm from underneath. Together they hauled him up, feet limp and toes dragging, and, amidst hurried activity in the doorway, the two young teenagers scrambling back in alarm, dragged him into the lighted doorway of the next room, where Boris's brunette was drawing up a syringe of something from a tiny glass bottle. 17. Going down in the cage elevator, we were suddenly encased in stillness. Grinding of gears, creaking of pulleys. The weather had cleared.
Come on,
Boris said to me, nervously glancing up the street. He had his phone out of his coat pocket.
Let's cross, come on.
What? I said. We just had the light if we hurried. Are you calling 911?
No, no,
said Boris distractedly, wiping his nose, looking around.
I don't want to stand here waiting for the car. I'm calling him to pick us up other side of the park. We'll walk across. Sometimes some of these kids push shots that are a little too big,
he said when he saw me looking anxiously back in the direction of the townhouse.
Don't worry, he'll be fine.
He didn't look fine.
No, but he was breathing, and Horst has Narcan. That'll bring him right out of it. Like magic, have you ever seen it? throws you right in withdrawal. You feel like shit, but you live. They should take him to the ER.
Why? Said Boris reasonably. What will the emergency people do? Give Narcan, that's what. Horst can give it to him quicker than they can.
And yes, he will come too, puking himself and feeling like stabbed to the head. But better there than in ambulance. Boom! Shirt cut open, mask jammed down on him, people slapping his face to wake him, laws involved, everyone very harsh and judgmental. Believe me, Narcan. Very, very violent experience. You feel bad enough when you come around without being in hospital. Bright lights and everyone very disapproving and hostile, treating you like shit. Drug addict, overdose, all these nasty looks. Maybe not letting you go home when you want. Psych ward, maybe. Social worker marching in to give you the big, so much to live for talk. And maybe on top of it all, nice visit from the cops. Hang on, he said. One moment, please. And started talking in Ukrainian on the phone. Darkness. Under the foggy corona of the street lamps, park benches slick with rain. Drip, drip, drip. Trees sodden and black. Sopping footpaths deep with leaves. A few solitary office workers hurrying home. Boris, head down, hands thrust in pockets, staring at the ground, had got off his call and was muttering to himself. Sorry, what? I said, looking at him sideways. Boris compressed his lips, tossed his head. Ulrika, he said darkly. That bitch. That was her that answered the door. I wiped my brow. I felt jittery and sick and had broken out in a cold sweat. How do you know these people? Boris shrugged. Horst? He said, kicking up a shower of leaves. We know each other from years back. I know Miriam through him. I am grateful to him for introducing us. And what? On the floor back there? Him? That fell? Boris made his old who knows face. They'll take care of him, don't worry, it happens.
They're always fine, really,
he said in a more earnest tone.
Because, listen,
he said, digging me in the side with his elbow.
Horst has these kids hanging around a lot. Changes a lot, always a new crowd. College age, high school age, rich kids mostly, trust fund, who might want to trade him some art or a painting they took maybe from their family. They know to come to him. Because,
tossing his head, tossing the hair from his eyes,
Horst himself, when he was a kid, you know, long time ago, 1980s, he went for 1 year or two to one of these fancy boys' schools around here where they make you wear the jacket. Someplace not too far away. He showed me it once, in the cab. Anyway, he sniffed, boy on the floor? He is not some poor boy from the street. And they will not let something happen to him. Let's hope he learns his lesson. Many of them do. He will never be so sick in his life after he gets that shot of Narcan. Besides, Candy's a nurse, and she'll look after him when he comes too. Candy, the brunette, he said, digging me again in the ribs again when I didn't answer. Did you see her? He chortled. Like,
he reached down and drew a fingertip above his kneecap to simulate the line of her boots.
She's terrific. God, if I could get her away from that Niall guy, the Irish, I would. We went out to Coney Island one day, just the two of us, and I never had such a good time. She likes to knit sweaters, can you imagine that?
He said, looking at me slyly from the corner of his eye.
Woman like that? Would you think she's a woman who enjoys to knit sweaters? But she does. Offered to make me one. She was serious, too. Boris, I will knit you a sweater any time you like. Just tell me what color, and I will do it.
He was trying to cheer me up, but I still felt too shaken to talk. For a while, we both walked with heads down, and there was no noise except the two of us clicking along the park path in darkness, our footsteps seeming to echo forever, and beyond the city night enormous around us, car horns and sirens sounding like they were coming from half a mile away.
Well, said Boris presently, throwing me another sideways glance. At least I've got it figured out now, huh?
What? I said, startled.
My mind was still on the boy, and my own near misses. Blacking out in the bathroom upstairs at Hobie's, head bloody where I'd hit it on the edge of the sink. Waking up on the kitchen floor at Carol Lombard's, with Carol shaking me and screaming, lucky it was 4 minutes. I was calling 911 if you didn't come to in 5.
Pretty sure of it. It was Sasha took the picture.
Who? Boris glowered.
Ulrika's brother, funny enough, he said, folding his arms across his narrow chest. And 2 boots make a pair, if you know what I mean. Sasha and Horst are pretty tight. Horst will never hear anything against him. Well, hard not to like Sasha. Everyone does. He's friendlier than Ulrika, but our personalities never came together. Horst was straight as string, they all say, till he fell in with those two. Studying philosophy, set to go into running the dad's company, and here you see him now. That said, I never thought Sasha would go against Horst, not in 100 years. You followed all that in there?
No.
Well, Horst thinks Sasha's word is gold, but I am not so sure. And I do not think the picture is in Ireland, either. Even Niall, the Irish, does not think it. I hate that she is back, Ulrika. I can't say plainly what I think, because, hands deep in pockets, I'm a little surprised Sasha would dare this, and I dare not say it to Horst, but I think no other explanation. I think whole bad deal, arrest, blow up with the cops, all that, was excuse for Sasha to make off with painting. Horst has dozens of people living off him. He is far too gentle and trusting. Mild in his soul, you know, believes the best of people. Well, he can let Sasha and Ulrika steal from him, fine. But I will not let them steal from me.
I hadn't seen very much of Horst, but he hadn't seemed particularly mild in his soul to me. Boris scowled, kicking at the puddles.
Only problem, though? Sasha's guy? The one he set me up with? Real name? No clue. He called himself Terry, which was not right. I don't use my own name either, but Terry? Canadian, give me a fucking break. He was from Czech Republic. No more Terry White than I am. I think he is street criminal, fresh out of jail. Know nothing, uneducated, plain brute. I think Sasha picked him up somewhere to use for shill, and gave him cut in exchange for throwing the deal. Peanuts kind of cut, probably. But I know what Terry looks like, and I know he has connections in Antwerp, and I am going to call my boy Cherry and get him on it.
Cherry?
Yes. He's my boy Victor's Sklitschka. We call him that because his nose is red, but also because his Russian name, Vitya, is close to Russian word for cherry. Also, there is famous soap opera in Russia, Winter Cherry. Well, hard to explain. I tease Vitya about this program. It makes him very annoyed. Anyhow, Cherry knows everyone, everything. Hears all the inside talk. 2 weeks before it happens, you hear it all from Cherry. So no need to worry about your bird, all right? I'm pretty sure we will sort it all out.
What do you mean, sort it out? Boris made an exasperated noise.
Because this is closed circle, you understand? Horst is right on the money about that. No one is going to buy this painting. Impossible to sell. But black market, barter currency, can be traded back and forth forever. Valuable, portable, hotel rooms, going back and forth. Drugs, arms, girls, cash, whatever you like.
Girls?
Girls, boys, what have you?
Look, look, he said, holding up a hand.
I am not involved in anything like that. I was too close to being sold myself as a boy. These snakes are all over Ukraine, or used to be, every corner and railway station. And I can tell you, if you are young and unhappy enough, it seems like good deal. Normal-seeming guy promises restaurant job in London, or what have you. Supplies air ticket and passport? Ha! Next thing you know, you are waking up chained by the wrist in some basement. Would never be involved with any such. It is wrong. But it happens. And once painting is out of my hands and Horst's, Who knows what it is being traded for? This group holds it, that group holds it. Point being, upheld forefinger, your picture is not going to disappear in collection of oligarch art freak. It is too famous. No one wants to buy it. Why would they? What can they do with it? Nothing. Unless cops find it, and they have not found it. This we know. I want the cops to find it. Well, Boris rubbed his nose briskly. Yes, all very noble. But for now, what I do know is that it will move, and only move in relatively small network. And Victor Cherry is great friend and owes me big. So cheer up, he said, grasping my arm. Don't look so white and ill, and we will talk soon again. I promise.
18. Standing under a street lamp where Boris had left me.
Cannot drop you home. I am late. Somewhere to be.
I was so shaken that I had to look around to get my bearings. Frothy gray facade of the Alwyn, like some lurid dementia of the Baroque, and the floodlights on the cutwork, the Christmas decorations on the door of Petrosian, struck some deep embedded memory gong. December. My mother in a snow hat.
Here, baby. Let me run around the corner and buy some croissants for breakfast.
I was so distracted that a man coming fast round the corner whacked straight into me.
Watch it!
Sorry, I said, shaking myself. Even though the accident had been the other guy's fault, too busy honking and yakking away on his cell phone to look where he was going, several people on the sidewalk had directed their disapproving looks at me. Feeling short-winded and confused, I tried to think what to do. I could catch the subway down to Hobie's, if I felt like catching the subway, but Kitsy's apartment was closer. She and her roommates Francie and Em would all be out on their girls' night. No point texting or calling, as I knew from experience. They usually went to a movie. But I had a key, and I could let myself in and make myself a drink and lie down while I waited for her to come home. The weather had cleared, wintry moon crisp through a gap in the storm clouds, and I began to walk east again, pausing every now and then to try and hail a cab. I wasn't in the habit of stopping by Kitsy's without phoning, mainly because I didn't care much for her roommates nor they for me. Yet despite Francie and Em and our stilted pleasantries in the kitchen, Kitsy's apartment was one of the few places I felt truly safe in New York. No one knew how to reach me at Kitsy's. There was always the sense that it was temporary. She didn't keep many clothes there and lived mostly out of a suitcase on a luggage rack at the foot of her bed. And for reasons inexplicable, I liked the empty, restful anonymity of the flat, which was cheerfully but sparsely decorated with abstract patterned rugs and modern furnishings from an affordable design store. Her bed was comfortable, the reading light was good, she had a big plasma screen television so we could lie around and watch movies in bed if we felt like it. And the stainless steel fridge was always well stocked with girl food, hummus and olives, cake and champagne, lots of silly takeout vegetarian salads, and half a dozen kinds of ice cream. Scrabbling for the key in my pocket, I absentmindedly unlocked the door, thinking about what I might find to eat. Would I have to order up? She would have had dinner, no point waiting, and almost bumped my nose when the door caught on the chain. I closed the door and stood for a minute, puzzled. I opened it again so it caught with a rattle. Red sofa, framed architectural prints, and a candle burning on the coffee table. Hello? I called and then again, hello? More loudly, when I heard movement inside. I'd been pounding loud enough to raise the neighbors when Emily, after what seemed like a very long time, came to the door and looked at me through the gap. She was wearing a ratty, at-home sweater and the kind of loudly patterned pants that made her rear end look a lot bigger. Kitsy's not here, she said flatly without unchaining the door.
Fine, I know, I said irritably. That's okay. I don't know when she'll be back.
Emily, whom I'd first met as a fat-faced 9-year-old slamming a door in my face in the barber's apartment, had never made any secret of the fact that she didn't think I was good enough for Kitsy.
Well, will you let me in, please? I said, annoyed. I want to wait for her.
Sorry, now's not a good time.
M still wore her wheat brown hair in a short cut with bangs, just as she had when she was a kid, and the set of her jaw, straight out of second grade, made me think of Andy, how he'd always hated her, Emmy Flemmy, the Emmalizer. This is ridiculous. Come on, let me in, I said again, irritably, but she only stood there impassively in the crack of the door, not quite looking me in the eye but somewhere to the side of my face. Look, Em, I just want to go back to her room and lie down. I think you'd better come back later, sorry, she said, in the incredulous silence that followed this. Look, I don't care what you're doing. Francie, the other roommate, made at least a pretense of sociability. I don't want to bother you. I just want to... Sorry. I think you'd better leave. Because, look, I live here, she said, raising her voice above mine. Good grief, you can't be serious. I live here, she was blinking in discomfort. This is my place, and you can't just come barging in here anytime you want. Give me a break. And, she was upset, too. Look, I can't help you. It's a really bad time now. I think you'd better just go, all right? Sorry. She was closing the door on me. See you at the party. What? Your engagement party? Said Emily, reopening the door a crack and looking at me so that I saw her agitated blue eye for a moment before she shut it again. 19. For some moments I stood in the hallway, in the abrupt stillness that had fallen, staring at the pinhole of the closed door, and in the silence I imagined I could hear M inches away on the other side of the door and breathing just as hard as I was. Well, that's it. You're off the bridesmaid list, I thought, turning away and clattering back down the stairs with a lot of ostentatious noise and feeling at once furious and oddly cheered by the incident, which more than confirmed every uncharitable thought I'd ever entertained about M. Kitsy had apologized more than once for M's brusqueness, but this, in Hobie's phrase, took the proverbial cake. Why wasn't she at the movies with the others? Was she with some other guy in there? M, though thick-ankled and not very attractive, did have a boyfriend, a dud named Bill who was an executive at Citibank. Shiny black streets. Coming out of the lobby, I ducked into the doorway of the florist next door to check my messages and text Kitsy before heading downtown, just in case. If she was just getting out of her movie, I could meet her for dinner and a drink, alone, without the girlfriends. The weirdness of the incident seemed to call for it. And, definitely, a speculative and humorous talk on the behavior of M. Floodlit window. Mortuary glow from the cold case. Beyond the fog condensed glass, trickling with water, winged sprays of orchids quivered in the fan's draft. Ghost white, lunar, angelic. Up front were the kinkier numbers, some of which sold for thousands of dollars. Hairy and veined, freckled and fanged and blood-flecked and devil-faced, in colors ranging from corpse mold to bruise magenta. Even one magnificent black orchid with gray roots snaking out its moss-furred pot. Please, darling, Kitsy had said, correctly intuiting my plans for Christmas. Don't even think about it. They're all too gorgeous, and they die the moment I touch them. No new messages. Quickly, I texted her. Hey, call me. Have to talk to you. Something hilarious just happened. XXXX. And just to be sure she wasn't out of the movie yet, dialed her cell again. But as it was clicking through to voicemail, I saw a reflection in the glass, in the green jungle depths in back of the shop, and, in disbelief, turned. It was Kitsy, head down, in her pink Prada overcoat, huddled arm in arm and whispering with a man whom I recognized. I hadn't seen him in years, but I knew him instantly. Same set of shoulder and loose-boned slink of a gait. Tom Cable. His crinkly brown hair was still long. He was still dressed in the same clothes that rich stoner kids had worn at our school. Tree-torns, huge thick-knit Irish sweater without an overcoat. And he had a bag from the wine shop looped over his arm, the same wine shop where Kitsy and I sometimes ran out together for a bottle. but what astonished me. Kitsy, who always held my hand at a slight distance, tugging me along behind her, swinging my arm playfully like a child playing London Bridge, was nestled deep and sorrowfully into his side. As I watched, blank at the unfathomable sight of this, they were waiting for the light, bus whooshing past, far too wrapped up in each other to notice me. Cable, who was talking to her quietly, tousled her hair and then turned and pulled her to him and kissed her. A kiss she returned with more mournful tenderness than any kiss she'd ever given me. Moreover, I saw, they were crossing the street. Quickly I turned my back. I could see them perfectly well in the window of the lighted shop as they went into the front door of Kitsy's apartment building, only a few feet away from me. Kitsy was upset. She was talking quietly, in a low voice, husky with emotion, leaning into Cable with her cheek pressed against his sleeve as he reached around lovingly to squeeze her on the arm. And though I couldn't make out what she was saying, the tone of her voice was all too clear. For even in her sadness, her joy in him and his in her was indisguisable. Any stranger on the street could have seen it. And as they glided past me in the dark shadow, a pair of affectionate ghosts leaning against each other, I saw her reach up quickly to dash a tear from her cheek and found myself blinking in astonishment at the sight. For somehow, improbably, for the first time ever, Kitsy was crying. 20. I was awake much of the night, and when I went down to open the store the next day, I was so preoccupied I sat staring into space for a half an hour before I'd realized I'd forgotten to turn the closed sign around. Kitsy's twice-weekly trips to the Hamptons. Strange numbers flashing, quick hang-ups. Kitsy frowning at the phone mid-dinner and shutting it off.
Oh, just M. Oh, just Mommy. Oh, just a telemarketer, they've got me on some list.
Texts coming in at the middle of the night. Submarine blips, bluish sonar pulse on the walls. Kitsy jumping up bare-assed from bed to shut the thing off. White legs flashing in the dark.
Oh, wrong number. Oh, just Toddy, he's out drunk somewhere.
And, very nearly as heart-sinking, Mrs. Barber. I was well aware of Mrs. Barber's light touch in tricky situations, her ability to manage delicate matters behind the scenes, and while she hadn't told me a direct lie, as far as I knew, information had definitely been elided and finessed. All sorts of little things were coming back to me, such as the moment a few months before when I'd walked in on Mrs. Barber and heard her saying in a low, urgent voice to the doormen over the intercom, in answer to a ring from the lobby,
"No, I don't care. Don't let him up. Keep him downstairs."
And when Kitsy, not 30 seconds later, after checking her texts, had bounced up and announced unexpectedly she was taking Tingling and Clemmy for a spin round the block. I hadn't thought a thing about it, despite the unmistakable frost of displeasure that had crossed Mrs. Barber's face, and the renewed warmth and energy with which, when the door clicked shut after Kitsy, she had turned back to me and reached to take my hand. We were to see each other that night. I was to accompany her to the birthday party of one of her friends, and then stop by the party of a different friend later on. Kitsy, though she hadn't phoned, had sent me a tentative text. "Theo, what's up? I'm at work. Call me." I was still staring at this uncomprehendingly, wondering if I should return the message or not. What could I possibly say? When Boris came bursting in the front door of the shop.
"I have some news."
"Oh yeah?" I said, after a moment's distracted pause. He wiped his forehead.
"We can talk here?" he said, looking around.
Shaking my head to clear it. "Sure."
"I have a sleepy head today," he said,
rubbing his eye. His hair was standing up in every direction.
"Need a coffee?"
"No. Don't have time," he said blearily, raising a hand. "Can't sit, either. Can only stay 1 minute. But, good news. I have a good line on your picture."
"How's that?"
I said, waking abruptly from my Kitsy fog.
"Well, we will soon see," he said evasively.
"Where?"
Struggling to focus.
"Is it all right?"
Where are they keeping it?
These are questions I cannot answer.
I was having a hard time collecting my thoughts. I took a deep breath, drew a line on the desktop with my thumb to compose myself, looked up.
Yes?
It needs a certain temperature range, and a certain humidity. You know that, right? Someone else's voice, not mine. They can't just be keeping it in a damp garage or any place.
Boris pursed his lips in his old derisive manner.
Believe me, Horst took care of that picture like it was his own baby. That said, he closed his eyes, I cannot say about these guys. I am sad to report that they are not geniuses. We will have to hope they have enough brains not to keep it behind the pizza oven or something.
Joking, he said loftily when he saw me gaping in horror.
Although, from what I hear, it is being kept in a restaurant, or near a restaurant. In same building with, anyway. We will talk about it later, he said, raising a hand.
Here? I said, after another disbelieving pause. In the city?
Later, it can wait.
But here is the other thing, he said in an urgently hushing tone as he looked about the room and over my head.
Listen, listen. This is what I really came to tell you. Horst. He never knew your name was Decker. Not until he asked me on the telephone today. You know a guy named Lucius Reeve?
I sat down. Why?
Horst says to stay away from him. Horst knows you are an antiques dealer, but he didn't connect the dots with this other thing until he knew your name.
What other thing?
Horst would not go into it a lot. I do not know what your involvement is with this Lucius, but Horst says to stay clear of him. And I thought it important that you know it right away. He crossed Horst badly on unrelated matter, and Horst got Martin after him.
Martin?
Boris waved a hand.
You didn't meet Martin. Believe me, you would remember if you did. Anyway, this Lucius guy is no good to be mixed up with for someone in your business.
I know.
What are you into him for, if I may ask?
Again, I shook my head at the impossibility of going into it. It's complicated.
Well, I don't know what he has on you. If you need my help, of course you have it. I am pledging it to you. Horst, too, I dare say, because he likes you. Nice to see him so involved and talkative yesterday. I do not think he knows so many persons with whom he can be himself and share his interests. It is sad for him. Very intelligent, Horst. He has a lot to give.
But, he glanced at his watch.
Sorry, I do not mean to be rude. I have to be somewhere. I am feeling very hopeful about the picture. I think, possibility, we may get it back. So,
he stood and bravely knocked his breastbone with his fist.
Courage. We will speak soon.
Boris.
Huh?
What would you do if your girl was cheating on you? Boris, heading for the door, did a double take.
Come again?
If you thought your girl was cheating on you. Boris frowned.
Not sure? You have no proof?
No, I said before realizing this wasn't strictly true.
Then you must ask her, straight out, said Boris decisively. In some friendly and unprotected moment when she is not expecting it. In bed, maybe. If you catch her at the right moment, even if she lies, you will know it. She will lose her nerve.
Not this woman.
Boris laughed.
Well, you have found a good one, then. A rare one. Is she beautiful?
Yes.
Rich?
Yes.
Intelligent?
Most people would say so, yes.
Heartless?
A bit. Boris laughed.
And you love her, yes, but not too much.
Why do you say that?
Because you are not mad or wild or grieving. You are not roaring out to choke her with your own bare hands, which means your soul is not too mixed up with hers, and that is good. Here is my experience. Stay away from the ones you love too much. Those are the ones who will kill you. What you want, to live and be happy in the world, is a woman who has her own life and lets you have yours.
He clapped me twice on the shoulder and then departed.
leaving me to stare into the silver case with a renewed sense of despair at my dirtied-up life. 21. Kitsy, when she opened the door to me that night, was not actually quite so composed as she might have been. She was talking of several things at once. New dress she wanted to buy, tried it on, couldn't decide, put it on hold. Storm up in Maine, tons of trees down, old ones on the island. Uncle Harry had phoned. How sad.
Oh, darling,
flittering around adorably, raising up on tiptoe to reach the wine glasses.
Will you, please?
Em and Francie, the roommates, were nowhere in evidence, as if they and their boyfriends had wisely am-scrayed before my arrival.
Oh, never mind, I've got them. Listen, I had such a good idea. Let's go have a curry before we stop by Cynthia's. I'm craving one. What's that hidey hole on Lex you took me to? That you like? What's it called? The Mahal something?
You mean the flea bag? I said, stonily. I hadn't even bothered to take off my coat.
Excuse me?
With the greasy Rogan Josh. And the old people that depressed you. The Bloomingdale's sale crowd. The Jal Mahal restaurant was a shabby, tucked-away Indian on the second floor of a storefront on Lex, where not a thing had changed since I was a kid. Not the papadums, not the prices, not the carpet faded pink from water damage near the windows, not even the waiters. The same heavy, beatific, gentle faces I remembered from childhood when my mother and I had gone there after the movies for samosas and mango ice cream.
Sure, why not? The saddest restaurant in Manhattan. What a great idea.
She turned to me and frowned.
Whatever. Bellucci's is closer. Or we can do what you want.
Oh, yeah? I stood leaning against the doorframe with my hands in my pockets. Years of living with a world-class liar had rendered me merciless. What I want? That's rich.
Sorry. I thought a curry might be nice. Forget it.
That's okay. You can stop it now. She looked up with a vacant smile on her face.
Excuse me?
Don't give me that. You know good and well what I'm talking about. She said nothing. A stitch appeared in her pretty forehead. Maybe this will teach you to keep your phone switched on when you're with him. I'm sure she was trying to call you on the street.
Sorry, I don't know.
Kitsy, I saw you.
Oh, please,
she said, blinking after a slight pause.
You can't be serious. You don't mean Tom, do you?
Really, Theo, she said in the deadly silence that followed.
Tom's an old friend, from way back. We're really close.
Yes, I gather.
And he's M's friend, too. And, I mean,
blinking furiously with an air of being unjustly persecuted.
I know how it may have seemed. I know you don't like Tom, and you have good reason not to. Because I know about the stuff when your mother died. And sure, he behaved really badly, but he was only a kid, and he feels really awful about the way he acted.
Feels awful?
But he'd had some bad news last night,
she continued rapidly, like an actress interrupted mid-speech.
Some bad news of his own.
You talk about me with him? You two sit around discussing me and feeling sorry for me?
And Tom, he turned up here to see us, Em and me, both of us, out of the blue. Right before we were supposed to go out to the movie. That's why we stayed in and didn't go out with the others. You can ask M if you don't believe me. He didn't have anywhere else to go. He'd had a bad upset, something personal. He only wanted someone to talk to. And what were we to...
You don't expect me to believe that, do you?
Listen, I don't know what M told you.
Tell me, does Cable's mother still have that house in East Hampton? I remember how she always used to dump him off at the country club for hours on end after she fired the babysitter, or after the babysitter quit, rather. Tennis lessons, golf lessons. He probably turned out to be a pretty good golfer, no?
Yes, she said coldly. Yes, he is pretty good.
I could say something cheap here, but I won't.
Theo, let's not do this.
May I run my theory by you? Do you mind? I'm sure it's wrong in a few particulars, but I think this is basically it. Because I know you were seeing Tom. Platt told me as much when I ran into him on the street, and he wasn't too thrilled about it either. And yeah, I said when she tried to interrupt, in a voice just as hard and dead as I felt. Right. No need to make excuses. Girls always did like Cable. Funny guy, really entertaining when he wants to be. Even if he has been writing bad checks lately, or stealing from people at the country club, or any of these other things I hear, that's not true. That's a lie. He never stole anything from anybody. And Mommy and Daddy never liked Tom much, or probably at all. And then after Daddy and Andy died, you couldn't keep it up. Not in public, anyway. Too upsetting to Mommy. And as Platt has pointed out numerous times, I won't see him anymore. So you're admitting it?
I didn't think it mattered until we were married.
Why is that? She brushed the hair from her eyes and said nothing. Didn't think it would matter? Why? You didn't think I would find out? Angrily, she glanced up.
You're a cold fish, you know that?
Me? I looked away and laughed. I'm the one who's cold?
Oh, right. Wronged party. Terribly high principles.
Higher than some, it seems.
You're thoroughly enjoying this.
Believe me, I'm not.
Oh, no? I'd never know it from that smirk.
And what am I supposed to do? Not say anything?
I've said I won't see him anymore. Actually, I told him I wouldn't a while back.
But he's insistent. He loves you. He won't take no for an answer. To my astonishment, she was blushing.
That's right.
Poor little kids.
Don't be hateful.
Poor baby, I said again, jeeringly, since I couldn't think of anything else to say. She was scrabbling in the drawer for the corkscrew, and she turned and regarded me bleakly.
Listen, she said, I don't expect you to understand, but it's rough to be in love with the wrong person.
I was silent. Walking in, I'd gone so cold with rage at the sight of her that I'd tried to tell myself that she was powerless to hurt me or, God forbid, make me feel sorry for her. But who knew better the truth of what she was saying than me?
Listen,
she said again, putting down the corkscrew. She'd seen her opening and she was taking it, just like on the tennis court, ruthless, watching her opponent's weak side. Get away from me. Too heated. Wrong tone. This was going the wrong way. I wanted to be cold and in control of things.
Theo, please.
There she was, hand on my sleeve, nose pinking up, eyes pink with tears, just like poor old Andy with his seasonal allergies, like some ordinary person you might actually feel sorry for.
I'm sorry. Truly. With all my heart. I don't know what to say.
Oh, no?
No. I've done you a great disservice.
Disservice. That's one way of putting it.
And I mean, I know you don't like Tom.
What does that have to do with it?
Theo, does it really matter to you as much as all that?
No,
you know it doesn't, she said quickly. Not if you have to think about it. Also,
she stopped for a moment before she plunged on.
Not to put you on the spot, but I know all about your things, and I don't care.
Things?
Oh, please, she said wearily. Hang out with your sleazy friends. Take all the drugs you want. I don't care.
In the background, the radiator began to bang and set up a tremendous clatter.
Look, we're right for each other. This marriage is absolutely the right thing for both of us. You know it and I know it. Because, I mean, look, I know. You don't have to tell me. And I mean, too, things are better for you now since we've been seeing each other, aren't they? You've straightened up a lot.
Oh, yeah? Straightened up? What's that supposed to mean?
Look,
she sighed in exasperation.
No point pretending, Theo. Martina, M, Tessa Margolis, remember her?
Fuck. I didn't think anybody knew about Tessa.
Everyone tried to tell me. Stay away from him. He's darling, but he's a drug addict. Tessa told M she stopped seeing you after she caught you snorting heroin at her kitchen table.
It wasn't heroin, I said hotly. They'd been crushed morphine tablets, and it had been a terrible idea to snort them. Total waste of a pill. And anyway, Tessa certainly didn't have any scruples about blow. She used to ask me to get it for her all the time.
Look, that's different, and you know it. Mommy...
she said, talking over me.
Oh, yeah?
Different? raising my voice over hers. How is it different? How?
Mommy, I swear, listen to me, Theo. Mommy loves you so much. So much. You saved her life coming along when you did. She talks. She eats. She takes an interest. She walks in the park. She looks forward to seeing you. You can't imagine how she was before. You're part of the family, she said, pressing her advantage. Truly. Because, I mean, Andy. Andy?
I laughed mirthlessly. Andy had entertained no illusions whatsoever about his sicko family.
Look, Theo, don't be like this.
She'd recovered now, friendly and reasonable, something of her father in her directness.
It's the right thing to do, marrying. We're a good match. It makes sense for everyone involved, not least us.
Oh, yeah? Everyone?
Yes.
Perfectly serene.
Don't be like that. You know what I mean. Why should we let this spoil things? After all, we're better people when we're with each other, aren't we? Both of us? And,
pale little smile, her mother there.
We're a good couple. We like each other. We get along.
Head, not heart, then.
If that's how you want to put it, yes,
she said, looking at me with such plain pity and affection that, quite unexpectedly, I felt my anger drop out from under me. At her cool intelligence, all her own, clear as a silver bell. Now, stretching up on tiptoe to kiss me on the cheek.
Let's both be good, and truthful, and kind to each other. And let's be happy together, and have fun always.
22. So I spent the night. We ordered in, later, and then went back to bed. But though on some level it was all easy enough, pretending everything was the same, because in some way, hadn't we both been pretending all along? On another, I felt nearly suffocated by the weight of everything unknown and unsaid, pressing down between us. And later, when she lay curled against me asleep, I lay awake and stared out the window, feeling completely alone. The silences of the evening, my fault, not Kitsy's, even in extremis, Kitsy was never at a loss for words, and the seemingly unbridgeable distance between us had reminded me very strongly of being 16 and never having the faintest idea what to say or do around Julie, who, though she definitely couldn't be called a girlfriend, was the first woman I'd thought of as such. We'd met outside the liquor store on Hudson, when I was standing outside, money in hand, wanting someone to go in and buy me a bottle of something. And there she came, billowing around the corner, in bat-like, futuristic garb, incongruous with her clumping walk and farm girl looks, her plain but pleasing face of a prairie wife of the 1900s.
Hey, kid,
hoisting her own wine bottle out of the bag.
Here's your change. No, really, don't mention it.
Are you going to stand out here in the cold and drink that? She was 27, nearly 12 years older than me, with a boyfriend just finishing business school in California, and there was never any question that when the boyfriend came back, I wasn't to come by or contact her ever again. We both knew. She hadn't had to say it. Galloping up the 5 flights to her studio, on the rare, to me, afternoons I was permitted to come see her, I was always bursting with words and feelings too big to contain. But all the things I'd planned to say to her always vanished the instant she opened the door. And instead of being able to engage in conversation for even 2 minutes like a normal person, I would instead hover speechless and desperate 3 steps behind her, hands plunged in pockets, hating myself, while she walked barefoot around the studio looking hip, talking effortlessly, apologizing for the dirty clothes on the floor, and for forgetting to pick up a 6-pack of beer. Did I want her to run downstairs? Until at some point, I would almost literally hurl myself at her mid-sentence and knock her over on the daybed, so violently sometimes my glasses flew off. It had all been so wonderful I thought I would die, but lying awake afterward I'd been sick with emptiness, her white arm on the coverlet, streetlights coming on, dreading the 8 o'clock hour which meant she would have to get up and dress for her job at a bar in Williamsburg where I wasn't old enough to stop in and visit her. And I hadn't even loved Julie. I'd admired her, and obsessed over her, and envied her confidence, and even been a little afraid of her. But I hadn't really loved her. no more than she'd loved me. I wasn't so sure I loved Kitsy, either. At least not the way I'd once wished I'd loved her. But still, it was surprising just how bad I felt.